1990 برنامه تاریخ شفاهی بنیاد مطالعات ایران مصاحبه با آقای منصور فرهنگ نوار سوم طرف آ نیویورک.
I was talking about the last days or weeks of Banisad's presidency, that how unrealistic he was with respect to the popular base or support for his position against Khomeini. There was very little, and to the extent that he could see organized support, it was usually staged by the majority. When he was forced out of his office, he went to his sister's, and then his sister's house was completely surrounded, and he had no place to go. And in my opinion, Mujahideen had played a significant role in the previous 6 months to bring him to that position, that he absolutely had to rely on them for his own survival. So they approached him in his sister's house and said, "We will, you know, save you." And they actually took him to the roof of that house and the next roof, and finally managed to come out to several houses away, and they put him in a cab and took him to one of their secret houses, and then they made a more formal contract or coalition with him, thinking that his position and prestige would help their strategy. And then they organized the famous Khordad demonstrations, which was a very sophisticated, and in fact they brought out all their forces, again thinking that in this type of confrontation with the regime, at least certain part of the general population would also rise up in their support, and that obviously led to failure. About these days they started searching for all individuals who were working or cooperating with Banisad or somehow associated with the opposition. Banisad was kind of almost a symbolic figure at this time. Many individuals who were very critical of Banisad were also in the same category. So this, during this period, in June 1980, a large number of Iranian activists or academics or intelligentsia, they were forced underground in the sense that they could no longer go to their homes. In my situation, I was staying at my sister's, that I received a phone call that they went to my apartment and looked for me, which at that stage I had absolutely no plan of going into hiding or any idea of exactly what I would do, which was perhaps really an indication of how blind or unrealistic one can become in the heat of political struggle, particularly for those who so closely and passionately identified with the revolution, that there would come a day when their security and survival is at stake. And still there was a feeling of disbelief that it is something which will pass. So, immediately I remember my mother, called, and she said, they moved into the apartment and they're staying inside, they don't let anyone to leave the building. There were three different apartments in that building, it was a three-story, place. They have closed the door, and only one woman on the second floor had persuaded the guard that she wants to go out to buy some milk for her child, and she came and called my mother, because we were family friends, called my mother and said, if you can get if you can contact Mansoor, tell him that the pastors have occupied the apartment, they're picking up some books and papers and things, and ask him not to come home. They thought that if they go in and make sure that nobody would leave the building, and they had disconnected the telephones in all three apartments, that the chances are that I would return home. And perhaps I would have. I had absolutely no intention. It was just a matter of luck that that particular evening I went to my sister's and had dinner there and spent the night there. I had no plan to stay away from the house. So when my mother called, we started thinking of finding a place. So if they're going to arrest me at the house, it's likely that they might go to my relatives' homes to look for me. At this stage, I made a couple of phone calls, and one couple who had even mentioned it jokingly earlier, several days earlier, that if you need a place to hide, you're welcome to come to our house, people who were not involved in politics, and they were not in any way known as critics or opponents of the regime. And when they first made this suggestion, just a few days earlier, I took it as a joke. Oh, how could it be possible that we will have to go into hiding? And it was not only being over-trusting and thinking that the regime would not be able to do it, but the fact that we were not a threat. I mean, all they needed to go to do to completely silence us and put us out of business was to shut down the newspaper, which they did. And I think a threat, or even, you know, just an intimidation, in my opinion, would have done the job in the case of the people in my category. Because we had no resources, we had no capacity. The only way we could do anything was to write or speak, and if there was no newspaper or organization to invite us, we would have been idle and useless. You know, I had kind of reasoned in a logical way that there is no reason for it. Nevertheless, they did it because of the demonstrations and the general strategy of creating an atmosphere of terror. So I went to these people's home, which was in the upper part of Tehran, without having any recourse or access to anybody. As time went on, listening to the radio or watching television, reading news, we that more and more people are being arrested, lots of people are being executed, you know, threats are being issued against, you know, individuals, that it became gradually far more serious. And then the thought of, you know, that the only way to survive, to escape, is to leave the country. And yet we had no connection, we had no, I had absolutely no understanding of knowledge of how one leaves the country surreptitiously. But the couple, they were very helpful. It took them about 2 months, but they finally managed to put me in contact with a smuggler. And I also established, you know, contact through these people with my parents. You know, at that time, both my parents were alive. And, you know, it was really a matter of what kind of smuggler you come into contact that determined the amount of money you had to pay to be taken across, you know, the border. Later on, I learned that there were people who paid only 15,000, 10,000 tumans. There were also people who paid over $1 million. In my case, it was something like almost 200,000. So I managed to get the money from family members. And someone showed up whose name was Haji with his own car. And I got into his car and we drove through Tehran to Qazvin and from there to Tabriz. We spent 2 nights. One night on the way to Tabriz and the second night in Tabriz. And then from Tabriz the following day, he drove me to Marand, which is toward Kilimaku. In Marand, he had a rendezvous with two other smugglers, and we waited for these people. They were late for a couple of hours, and they finally showed up. and it was a very interesting kind of moment. He knew exactly what I had given him. I had an expired Iranian passport without any kind of visa or anything. He took that passport away from me in Tehran. He also knew exactly how much money I had and how much of the money was in dollars, in Toman. I had something like a couple hundred dollars and a couple thousand in 2 months. So in Maran, literally the last minute as he was saying goodbye to me, he said, you know, I have been doing this for many years and I have helped lots of people here across the border, and you can be sure that these two Kurdish individuals will take you there safely and all that, but to make absolutely certain that you will leave the country without any kind of threat and so forth, I think you should give some money to a mosque in Tabriz, that this Nazr it was impossible for me to say no. And he said, every time I leave, it is simply, and the money has to come from the person who is actually escaping in order to be effective. So it's 1,000 tuman, and I urge you to give me another 1,000 tuman. And obviously at that moment he knew exactly how much. I said, fine, here is another 1,000 tuman. So I gave him the money. You wouldn't believe it. These two other guys who picked me up, they put me in this Paycon, which was a very old car and not really in good shape. We drove about maybe 5 or 10 kilometers out of the Marand toward Maku. And these people, I learned later on, that they had a rendezvous with two other smugglers, somewhere exactly between Marand and Maku. Our car broke down after after 5 or 10 kilometers of driving, and these two men in the car, they were obviously drug addicts. Real heroin addicts, and it was so of the people, probably both of them in the late 40s or early in the 50s, with very little energy. So they came in and the car couldn't, they couldn't start the car, and I started, two of us pushed the car and one was sitting behind him. We did this for about half an hour, just pushing it, and they finally managed to get the car. It was so, it was comical and frightening in the both. It reminded me of sort of like a scene I would see in a Woody Allen movie. You know. So we went to a gas station, you know, on the way. And in the gas station, which was not at all crowded, we sat in that gas station for 3 hours waiting for the people who were coming from, you know, Maku. And finally they showed up. It was another, you know, paper, number three. And these, that here, the smugglers were very young. One of them could hardly speak Persian, just Kurdish and Turkish. But one of them was very good. So I got into their car. And the first thing they told me, that if we are ever stopped on the way by gendarmes or by pastors, we tell them that we picked you up, you asked for a ride, and we are just giving you a ride. Don't say that you're related to us, or don't say anything about, you know. And obviously, when they give you instructions, all you say is yes, yes, yes. And nothing happened. So we drove to Maku, and from Maku they went to this village, which was probably 5-10 kilometers through toward the border. We went there and waited until it was dark, and then. In the same car we said, they were very nice, it was a Kurdish kind of village. We did some walking in one particular part that we had to go through some, you know, rough areas, that they were able to drive on the road, even go, even pass the patrol stations, because there was some agriculture and some villages, you know, beyond that, but they couldn't have anyone else, you know, in the car. So one of them came with me, we went through, you know, a round way, through the mountainous area. It took us probably an hour to walk for no more than a kilometer or so. So we got into this car, and I had only one small bag with me, shaver and very elementary thing, and one book, just one book and a notebook. We got into this car and we drove, and here is into the road going up the hill, and I was told that we had to walk about 5 to 6 miles from where we will be dropped off by the car to this village in Turkey, Koy, which was, you know. And then, we got into this car, as we started driving, and suddenly, like driving not even a kilometer, suddenly we saw 3 Pop Stars. Fortunately, their car, which was a small Toyota truck, a station pickup truck, it was on one side of the road, and the other side there was enough space for this kind of pick on, you know, to go by. They were just standing there, and one of them, you know, raised in the hand to stop our car. And they started talking in Kurdish and Turkish to each other, and they said, "We are not going to stop." So they passed by the border guards. They were not really border guards, because they had already passed the border. They were pastors who were kind of patrolling into the area, largely with respect to smuggling. I don't think political type of thing was any of their concern. Human smuggling. So it was a very intense moment. I said, "Well, what if they shoot?" You know. And he said, "No, they won't. They might come after us." So as soon as we went by the guards, they got into the car and turned around and started following us. And then as we went up the hill, the road became kind of zigzag, but this time it was dark. It was a zigzag road, a 90-degree turn. So when we drove about 10 minutes and they were still following us, this station wagon was still following us, they said, "Well, we will have to let you out here with one of us and let the car follow us, but you will get out." So in one 90-degree turn, they stopped the car for about probably no more than 5 seconds, pushed me out of the car. It was on the edge of a cliff, and they said that it jumped down, and there was the wheat fields, you know, in the area. So I jumped into the wheat fields, and one of the 3 men in the car also jumped out with me, and he pushed my head down. He said, "Just lay down, you know, on the ground in the wheat field." We sat there something like for about 3 or 4 minutes until the car following us, you know, reached this corner. They did it so professionally that they had done this before, probably with this, that the car behind us could not see this stop because it was such a sharp turn. So the car continued to follow the other one. We sat there. As a result of this, and we got up and started, he said, "Run." And I had a terrible problem. The shoes I had, they were absolutely the most worst shoes you could imagine for walking and running in such, you know, rough territory. So as a result of that, instead of walking the original plan of walking 5 seconds, we walked 11 hours. So we went a number of times on the way. I was incapable of continuing the walking, so we had to stop and all that. So, but nevertheless, we crossed, and when we got to the border, this guy who was with me, which was another, you know, interesting, he started making a sound, not ar-ar, but this, I don't even know exactly what the English expression is. And someone from the other, now here where we are standing, we see the Turkish border post. We also hear their dogs barking, the light and all that. someone responded exactly with the similar, you know, sound, and then he asked me to follow him. We managed to get together to meet at one particular spot, and then there was one area, I would say probably about 20 or 30 kind of meters on the hill, and he asked me to lay down on the ground and crawl, because sometimes they put searchlights and can see, you know, anything. So they didn't, but he said, you know, this is the safe way to do. So we crawled on. And then when we got to the other side, he said, now you're on Turkish territory, and I can tell you that even if they bust you here, they will not send you back, particularly if you tell them that you're a political, you know, person and all that. The chances are that you're safe, but still it's possible, as, you know, a good number of people used to get busted on Turkish. But it didn't happen to us. So when we walked, very close to, later I learned it was about a couple of kilometers before we got to the village, I passed out. And the passing out was also largely due to my feet were just bleeding and swollen, that I just couldn't continue. So he asked me to stay by a stream. He said, just lay down here, I will be back, you know. And he put me there alone, and he went back, and he returned, they were fantastic. He returned with a horse, you know. And he put me on the horse and led the horse to this, you know, village. And later I learned that it wasn't really, you know, the long distance. So I stayed in this, in the village. I went in, and after a while I spent that day there. It was daytime. When we got there, it was complete daytime. I spent one night there. The next day, a car came, and they had all these smugglers, they had connections, but all part of the same connection with Tabriz and Tehran. This Haji was apparently the ringleader, and he was in contact with him. So the next day, I gave him my passport, and from there we drove to Dubayazid, which is, you know, a small town of about 5,000 people, very close to Bazargan border on the Turkish side. So they took my passport, and I spent 7 days there. They said they took the passport to Istanbul. It had the entrance stamp of Istanbul International Airport. They said the only way to, we have to take this passport to Istanbul to do it and bring. And there was another person who actually stopped by too. And I stayed in this Turkish village. The father was very much opposed to what the son was doing, and he knew some Persian. He knew some Persian, so we could come in. And they had a 12-year-old son who was studying English in the school, and I became his English teacher for a week while waiting and all that. And, you know, there was nothing to read, and I lost my bag on the way. When we jumped down the cliff, the bag was gone and all that. It wasn't possible to. So I taught this kid English, and through the English-Turkish dictionary communicated, you know, a little bit, and the bag. But they were extremely generous and kind. When I was leaving the home, I tried to give them some money. They didn't accept it. You know, the father used to say, complain to the son who was in charge of my trip, that they used to word the word haram, that, you know, what you do is, you know, the money you're gaining. He came home once with the radio and some equipment, and he told him I could understand what they were talking about, and he was telling him that, you know, you're buying these things with haram money and you shouldn't be doing it. And they were extremely generous and hospitable. The father, his wife, and they had a young daughter. They took a bath there. They were so fantastic. And at the end, I tried to give them dollars. They didn't accept it. Later on, when I came to California, I bought something and sent it to them. You know, because the daughter was getting married. And from there, I took the bus from Dubayazid to Erzurum. And from Erzurum, I took another bus. That was the only, I tried to get the plane ticket and all that, but you had to wait for a long time. It wasn't available. So I decided to go on the bus. So we were all the way to Istanbul. And there, it took me 2 weeks. And there, Ahmad Salamatian and a member of the, you know, of, leader of the Mujahideen, they had also left Tehran together. They also had a very interesting kind of a story. So we all got together in Istanbul, and it took us 2 weeks. I went to the American embassy to get a visa, and they didn't give it to me. Particularly when they gave me the application, and you know, they ask you, have you ever been to the United States? Have you ever had a visa? You say, well, I used to be a citizen of the United States. So you immediately become suspicious. So they arranged an interview. When they learned about me, they arranged an interview, under the, disguising it under an interview which was related to visa, but it wasn't at all. They arranged the interview for 2 days later, and the person who came to interview me came from Ankara, and there is absolutely no question in my mind that he was an intelligence officer. And I talked to him as if I was talking to a classroom or a seminar, you know, and all that. And at the end, as a result of that interview, he said, well, we really, this interview has nothing to do with the visa. He was open once he got to know me and all that. He was even apologetic. But the decision has to do. And then the other guy said, well, you know, it's not that, it has nothing to do with your background, but your children live in the States, you know, you're married and your wife is in the United States and all that. It's obvious that you want to go and stay there, so you're qualified for permanent residency. You could submit the application for permanent residency, and it takes time and all that. Maybe that was accurate. But they could give me a visitor's visa if they wanted. So I couldn't. So we got a French visitor visa to France. And in France, I was there for about a month or so until I managed to get, still not a permanent, but a visitor's visa. And came to the States. Yes, I went to the States, and you know, then I went to Princeton for 2 years. When I went there, I reapplied for permanent residency or change of status, which was easy to get, really, because of my situation. I was actually invited there. Richard Falk was there. I had been invited before I went to Iran, and I declined. And I was in California. There was even a possibility for me to regain my old, you know, position, which I didn't want to. I didn't try. It was a research fellowship, so it was acceptable. And then also, once I was there, I was also asked to teach a course for a year, which I found it very, you know, helpful. So I was there. I had a couple of prospects for a job in California. But after being the Pocahontas, I was invited to Bennington just for 1 year. They had a special position as a visiting, you know, scholar. And I went there. I loved the place. I was, after teaching there for a semester, I was dreaming that they would ask me to stay. And they did. And I had no hesitation to say, yes, and I've been there since.
Just one more question. You sort of knew firsthand both Balistan and Yazdi and Bozadeh and Bozada. What do you think of each of these people in terms of their capacity, management capacity, political acumen?
I would say politically the most astute and individual is Yazdi, no question about it. Managerially, there is absolutely no question. He's a very good manager. And I would say he's even talented, you know, in that sense. Ideologically, he was a divided man. And in my opinion, he continues to be divided. He has no fundamental cultural objection to what is happening in Iran. And yet he has some very strong liberal sensibilities about political freedom that he could not cooperate with the regime. on a more power-oriented basis, Yazdi had a hard time, and in fact is the kind of individual who has a hard time to be subservient, particularly to the people he does not respect. He is a highly educated man, not only with respect to his profession as a chemist and a cancer researcher, but also he is a learned man with respect to his own religious interests. And he has done a lot of work on his own. So he had a lot of self-confidence. Self-made man, self-confidence, manager, organizer, and politically astute. So finally, at the end, he played with the idea. He broke away from them because he could not submit to the dictation of the people he did not respect. He could not also face the idea of taking part in the suppression of people like Bazargan, and for whom he had immense respect. Qutbzadeh was a shrewd political operator.